Good morning.
Good morning.
How good to see you all. It is my great joy and honor to introduce our guest speaker for today, Sister Pearl, a dear friend of this community. Sister Pearl has, some of you may know her from when she was working at the Mayo Clinic as a physician's assistant and would come up here to visit occasionally. But in 2019, Sister Pearl was ordained as a nun in the Vietnamese bamboo forest tradition and has been in residence and at residential monastic Zen communities for the last 4 or 5 years, including a couple years at Upaya Zen Center and the last year, I think, at Atlanta Soto Zen Center, where she was completing her chaplaincy training, serving as a resident at Emory University Hospital. You know, Pearl moves smoothly between Soto Zen, Bamboo Forest, and Plum Village traditions, and we'll be staying Plum Village is the Tikkun tradition. We'll be staying down there at Magnolia Grove for a few months, I think, before returning to Vietnam. So we have a long, deep connection for which I am so grateful. I was able to travel in Vietnam for a few weeks with Sister Pearl earlier this year, and we're so grateful to have you here for this offering. And before I bow, I'm going to make this just a little bit. Oh, it's the camera. I think whoever is running the camera may want to tip it down just a little bit. You can have a look.
Thank you, Jimmy.
All right. Thank you all, and thank you, Pearl.
Thank you, Ben, for the very warm welcoming introduction, and greetings to everyone, to all the wonderful friends who are here today, and to the friends online. Nice to see you. Every one of you are right in front of me. So I have guests on the sides and online friends in front of me. I feel surrounded by wonderful spiritual friends here. How's everyone doing today?
Good.
I think most of you came and sat this morning, correct? And it's I sat here a few times before. And somehow today the space felt, I think it's the most crowded I ever had. And it felt very quiet, very serene. Even though we hear the airplane, the car, and at the same time we hear the birds singing and the wind blowing, the trees, the whispering of the leaves. It's just such a beautiful space, and I feel so honored to be here with you all. What a blessing we have. You know, I think that I guess every one of us want to come here for a reason, correct? We wake up this morning and we know that today we're going to show up here. And some of us come, we want to find some kind of peaceful moment. Some of us come to have connection with others, or learning new things, or practicing, or to be more self-disciplined, or to bring some joy to the world. But there's something that's driving us to come here today, and something that's driving us to wake up every morning to live another day. And how wonderful it is to wake up in the morning and feel so blessing, so grateful that we're still alive, that we still breathe and be here and able to walk out the house and to get here and to sit here together in this room, connecting to other people. Isn't that a miracle, a blessing? COVID-19 has taught us so much about how impermanent life is and how precious our little life and fragile our life is at the same time. And it taught me a lot During COVID-19, I stayed at Upaya Zen Center for 2 years. I get ordained in 2019, and I in 3 o'clock in the morning at the Dai Dang Monastery in San Diego, and that evening I left the monastery in San Diego, came to the monastery where my ordained teacher stayed. To stay there for 4 months, kind of original training and practice. And then I decided to come back here to finish my chaplaincy training because I was in the middle. And somehow as I got to Upaya Zen Center, just as a 4 month resident, COVID hit. Like 3 days later, we shut down. The entire Upaya Zen Center, we shut down. So I got there 3 days earlier. I was so lucky. And I stayed there for the rest for 2 years. And we were very strict guidelines. We did not go anywhere. And during that time, we had this kind of online practice with other people around the world. And about 16 to 20 residents stayed there together, variously. You know, the number up and down, but we are average about 15, 16 residents. And we heard news around the world that track down how many, you know, each day, how many people have gone, how many people newly contract. And our heart kind of pouring out to the outside world, why we feel blessing to have a place to practice and stay healthy, and stay isolating and to keep ourselves as healthy as possible. And during that time was the time that I feel like it was the cradle of my spiritual life, because that was when I deeply dived into my practice of a monastic setting. It's, I think that sharing, just kind of recognizing that we're here together is a blessing, and we will not have this moment again of the same people here again, of the same mindset, of the same physical condition again, like this. This moment will pass and we'll never get back this moment again. So I just want to say I'm very grateful. And I appreciate to be here this moment with you all. And let us spend this moment together fully as much as possible. And I would not talk much. I would like to have some engagement later. But at first, I would like to introduce you all, also my Dharma sister here. Her name is Ping Cheng, which means original peer meditative mind. So she's been ordained for 10 years, and in our tradition, we usually try to travel together, at least two, as a power of Dharma friendships, sisterhood or brotherhood, and a support of each other. So she doesn't speak English, but she's very wise. And she's my teacher. Among many teachers, I learn a lot from her. Currently, she is staying at the Zaktan Meditation Center in Eagan. She just sent here from San Diego 2 years ago. I mean, 2 months ago to take care of the place. And currently, I'm staying with her while I'm visiting here. She was also previously my ex-husband's mother. So my ex-mother-in-law. and now we are Dharma sister. So we met many years ago. We met I would say more than 15 years ago. And when I first met her, I knew instantly this is a great friend. I met her before I met my ex-husband. And I want to share with you because I think that our spiritual path is very interesting. I never knew I would become a nun. And I don't have much wisdom of the Dharma to share with you, but what I can share with you is my path, my spiritual journey. And I would also invite you to check in with yourself of your own spiritual journey. of the many peoples or conditions or situations or things that you have passed by in your life, that you have exposed to, that you have experienced, that make you to become who you are today and make up the you, the pure, the true you now. And before I continue, I would like to pay respect to my ancestors, teachers, my grandmaster, Thich Thanh Từ, from my Zen lineage in Vietnam, to Zen master Thầy Thích Nhất Hạnh, and my own root ordination teacher from Vietnam, as well as many teachers I have met, including Ben Connolly here, who was my spiritual director while I was at while I was in my chaplaincy training program. And so Ben has helped me a lot in also finding my path as well. So it was, I remember when I came to United States in 1996, I was only a little girl, a teenager, 13 years old, and I did not know any English. And it, I had to really push myself hard to study English, including locking myself up in the bathroom or the closet to find some quiet space in the house so that I can push myself to study English fast. And I knew my parents came here for freedom of America. We are blessed to have that freedom here. Freedom of speech, freedom of news, media, those things, economy. And I told myself that I have to really study hard so that my parents, you know, it was for my parents' trip to leave everything at home, their own family, their parents, their siblings to come here for my education. And so I, when I came here, I did not know anything about the Vietnam War, because we had that connection, right? American-Vietnam War back then. And I did not know much. And I was raised in a kind of government school, public school, where we learned, you know, like communist communism, kind of like dogma and those theory. And I grew up, I only know, maybe that's the form of government that works for us, right? And so when I came here, I heard everything opposite from what I learned in Vietnam. And I was so shocked between culture shock, language, you know, different, and all of these kind of like way of life, government, how to run the country and everything is totally different. And I was like, how come people can ingrain in you a different theory or philosophy or things that make you to believe fully that was? As a teenager, I asked a lot of those questions. And I did not believe, I did not know who to trust, whether I trust back in my country what I was taught or I would trust here, because it's so different. And I asked my dad his experience during the war, and you know, he had gone through a lot of hardship. He was fighting from the south against the communists, right? And he was put in a labor camp for 5 years, away from family, while my mom was at home with five little girls, age 1 to 6, alone, waiting for my dad to come home and not knowing when he would come home. So 5 years later, he was released to come home with just bones and skins, and because he worked really hard with very little food, and you know, just labor camp trying to make you like reduced to nothing, basically. It's not as harsh as concentration camp, but it's also very harsh on your body. And I did not know anything about this. I didn't even know about how hard my mother life was, and my sister died during the time, and other siblings, other aunts and uncle, you know, being gone and never find again. And so all of that I just knew as a teenager, 13 years old, all that suffering, and my childhood back in Vietnam was very pinky, very, you know, the innocent, did not know what suffering was. And so I tried to went into the public library and find all the books, all the different videos, documentary, recording to learn by myself so that I can gather my own research instead of trusting who tell me what. And after I gather all the different resources, I saw the horrible of the war and how bad the war is. And both sides, the side who lost, the side who won, all the villagers, all the people, all sides suffer. I saw American soldiers being, you know, in prison afterward. I saw Vietnamese communist soldiers being tortured. So both sides have all the suffering, and their families suffer too. So I think I had post-secondary trauma from seeing all of that and reading all of that, that I, even myself, I dream, in my dream, I had nightmare, and I saw I was in the front line of the war bombing, and my body blast, and just get, like, I just, like, I saw my own skeleton, basically, as a teen, dying in the battlefield. And whenever someone talk about the war at the time or my family, I just cry. I couldn't hold it. And I remember my first few years, I just cry almost every day. And we learn about the Vietnam War in the in the US history, junior high school, junior year. And I couldn't hold it when I see the images in the front, the teacher talk about, I just cry. And the teacher did not know why I cried the whole class and had to excuse myself. Somehow that really triggered me to really seeking what is life. I ask why people hurting each other, why people create this war, why people take sides, why don't we just live in peace and support each other and loving each other? What is the meaning of life? What is suffering? What is death? What is the meaning for living? So I asked all those questions, and my mind was so confused, and it's kind of ram on. And wherever I heard the news about, like, in Africa, children have hunger issues, or about disaster somewhere, whenever I see suffering, I just couldn't hold my tears, and I feel my own body would suffer so much. And I got to college. I want to become a politician, working for United Nations. Like, what you call, like, peace, you know, working for United Nations. Yeah, ambassador, right? Peace ambassadors. I want to become a pilot. So all they're like, what do I want to become? But then, you know, like, political is too much for me. Too much headache. You know, it can be a sword with two edges, right? I don't think I can handle that. Maybe I do something that, you know, bring happiness, bring healing to people. With less harming, so I decided medicine, and I studied really hard in pre-med program at St. Olaf. And at the time, I was exploring different religions. I did not know much about Buddhism, even though I'm from Vietnam. But it's more of a, like, a cultural, like, here in America, we are like cultural Christian, right? We kind of, some of us go to church, but we don't really know, like, what is the teaching of the Buddha, or what is the real teaching of Christ. So same as me in Vietnam, I know there was a Buddha, I know we should do good, avoid doing bad, but I didn't really know what the Buddha taught, or his life. And so when I was, you know, suffering with these thoughts in my mind about what is meaning of life, what is, why do we live here, this world crazy like this, I try to seek out my answers to exploring different religions like Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, yoga, all of that. And I, at Central Love College, I took Bible classes. It's a Lutheran college. So I took Bible classes. I went to Bible study group. And I went to the chapel of the college very often with my friend and my best friend, who was my roommate, wanted to convert me into Christianity. And I was like hesitant, like, wait, I want to learn more before I commit myself. So after I learned more, including Buddhism, I found it gave me an answer for why there's suffering. Because Buddha, that was the main teaching of the Buddha, is about suffering is part of life. And there is a path, there's a way to get out of suffering, and that's the Eight Noble Path. And we can practice and we can find peace right in this moment. And we can see the result right now. We don't have to wait until we get enlightenment and go to the Pure Land. But we can find peace and the Pure Land right here on Earth. Whether it's hell or it's heaven, it's the state of our mind, right? And so my first book that I was exposed to was Thich Nhat Hanh, Peace is Every Step. Some of you familiar with that? Peace is Every Step. That was my first book of Buddhism that I read about. And I was in awe. I realized that, oh, in my mind, there was so much war. Fighting, criticizing, judging people, anxious, anguish. And I did not have any peace in my mind. If I don't have peace in my mind, how can I hope find peace outside, right? I was blaming the politicians. I was blaming the different sides of the fighting. And I was always sad and anguished and mad and angry at the state of the world. I didn't have my own peace. Then what's the point of bringing peace to others or bringing healing to others? So I realized that I have to work on myself first, just returning to myself and not projecting out and asking others to change or asking the world or the society to change. So that's what I start with. And I found that with meditation practice, while I was in college, it helped me find some calmness, some peace, some stillness, and then some clarity of mind. And my roommate, my friend, she was so worried that she keep writing me letter, telling me, to consider my my decision, and that Christianity is great, and Jesus always welcomed me into His arm. And I asked, Jesus, please answer me if you really do. Can you let me know some sign? And I love Jesus too, but I couldn't find a way that I feel the poor, even though I feel Jesus also a great teacher and He also is a peacemaker too. But destination somehow pulled me more toward Buddhism because it answered my question about suffering. And Thich Nhat Hanh, my first time saw him, he was in his brown robe like this. He was with a big speaker. He was at one of the Thailand ocean shore, and he was helping the refugees, the boat people, to come in. So he was out there engaging and helping people. And that was the first sight that I saw a Buddhist monk doing this kind of work. In my childhood, I also see monks and nuns like in the temples, like that are in the movie. But I did not really see any monk or nun like out there in the world working and being with the people. And that inspired me so much. That I in my mind I thought I want to be like him at the time. That was my freshman in high school. I mean in the college. And somehow it's always pulling me, wanting to study Buddhism, wanting to spiritual path. And there was a dream in sophomore year that I saw was a nun working in the field, turning the soil, but I ignored that dream. I'm like, nah, I'm going to become a doctor. No, that's maybe just a funny, you know, kind of funny dream. And then I keep going, you know, medical school and stuff. And I was dating at the time and falling in true love. And we have a wonderful relationship with, you know, very much pure love and respect each other in college. And I went to PA school and I finished that. And right after I finished PA school, I came back to Rochester. And I went to a meditation retreat with my Dharma sister here. I took her everywhere when we go to spiritual retreat meditation every Sunday. I took her everywhere, just me and her, and other you know members in my car. So at that first intensive 1 full week meditation retreat in Oklahoma, my teachers, my 5 precept teachers, during his Dharma talk, he read a poem about true love, universal love. And that was the mark of my turning point. Would you like to hear that poem?
Yes.
Yes? Okay, I record it here. It's in Vietnamese, but I translate into English. And at the time I was dating, and I already engaged, and I was about to get married. But then when I heard this poem, it say, I have a devoted deep love, loving life and loving the world, the love that overflowing the universe, not just only loving the beautiful guests. If the beautiful guests want to be loved, then return to your inner heart and mind. Dedicate toward the service of humanity. You will meet my love in that word. I am devoted to this deep love, being sworn with the morning light over the mountains. The love that's not direct to any individual person, loving all living beings and loving all creatures. So after I heard him read that poem, I just broke down and cried, like there was a spring coming up. It's touching my heart, and it's like a reminder that I have lost for a lifetime, that it's come back. I'm like, oh, I want to become a nun. I knew that time for sure. I really want to become a nun. That was the mark. And I just like burst out and like, what should I do? In our tradition, a nun or monk had a celibacy vow, and we should not be married. It's okay if we already married, but we have to renounce our family life, and we do a monastic, you know, life afterward, after our death. And so my Dharma sister at the time, she was also a mother, not ordained yet. But she also wanted to ordain when she was 14 years old, but somehow life took a turn and she had to get married. She knew that was her karma to have family, and she knew she fulfilled all of that. And when she got retired, she said she wanted to get ordained after retirement. So I was trying to support her, you know, like to be there to support her. So she was still working at the time. And I come to her and say, like, I already called her mother at the time. I was like, mother, I want to get ordained to become a nun, but what should I do with your son now? I'm like, I love him, you know, true love, but I have a bigger love, and I don't think I'm able to stay home for this one single love. I feel like my life is out there, not like just at home. And at that time, I did not know Soto Zen yet. It's more of my own bamboo forest tradition with my inspiration from Thich Nhat Hanh, from Pima tradition, so kind of like a both way. And she said, well, you just graduated from PA school. You have 100,000 loans to pay off. and your, you know, my whole family, my parents, like none of them know Buddhism, and so it will be a shock for them if I leave, and who will pay off my loan? And she really know, like, I know your heart, and I'm not, you know, text side my son. I know you love him and he loves you, but if it's your destination, you should follow your heart, but you have to take care of your things first, so that when you go, you don't have to have anything you worry about. When you go, go with the free spirit. And so I really appreciate her advice at the time. She was all support and loving. And she loved her son. That's her first son, her oldest son. She loved her son dearly. But she knew my heart, and she loved me as her own daughter too. Or we might be teacher, disciple past life, or we might be Dharma, sister, brother's past life. We don't know. But we felt a strong connection. And so I like, okay, I just practice patience. And I share with my fiance at the time, when I came back, I share in my heart because I want to be true, you know, and not hide anything. And that was a difficult time for us. But we talk, and he's also a great gentleman. I would call him my bodhisattva because he taught me a lot, and he's very supportive. And even though he was sad and shocking, but he already knew that I'm kind of a spiritual person. And he said he support my decision, whatever I decide. And so finally, we decide to continue on. We're not, you know, because I just want, but I don't know, like, what lineage I should go into, who's my teacher. I did not know clearly. I just want to become a nun, but don't know what would that be like. And so we decide to stay together as a spiritual couple and support each other. And if the time that I'm ready to leave, he said he would support me for that. And so I really very thankful, very grateful for his support. And so I took care, I work at Mayo Clinic as a PA in palliative care. Taking care of people who are seriously ill and hospice patients. And also those years in the cancer department, so almost 10 years of Mayo Clinic. And those years taught me a lot because suffering is right there. Not the bigger suffering of war or natural disaster, but this is more individual, personal suffering and affecting the family. And I saw young people die. I saw a couple who just get married. Who are nurses, who are healthy, and 2 years later found out colon cancer and died from that. I saw a baby died. I saw very rich people, like a millionaire, died. I saw politicians who came very high status and very sick and did not have much time left. So it's just right there in my face, which reminds me the impermanence of life. But at the same time, there's joy, there's love, there's hope, there's that, you know, all of that taste of life interweaving each other as we interact with each other. And so it actually helped me, my bodhicitta, it helped me even have a stronger desire or inspiration to become a nun. It clarified my purpose, it clarified my inspiration. Like, yes, I need to continue, go on to get ordained. Finally, I get ordained into my traditions, which is very much like Soto Zen. We do a lot of sitting meditation. And our key teaching is returning, illuminating your own mind, kind of coming back in and illuminating the inner mind and not to distract ourselves so much. My grandmaster, who I always respect, he wrote this poem when he was 9 years old. And when I heard about that, I feel like, you know, this is the lineage that I would be with. And in my dream, I also saw that I came and bowed in front of him. And he nodded his head, and that's make me decide that this is the lineage that I'm with. So he wrote this poem when he was 9 years old that shook him up like mind experience with the other poem. He was walking up the mountain to visit his sick uncle. And when he hear the bell of the temple, he had this poem. Oh, how joyful the serenity of the mountain, a peaceful place for everyone. Awakened by the sound from the wooden fish, heard the roar of life echo in the bell tone. Only 9 years old, he wrote this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he was the one who revived Vietnamese Zen that was lost in the 13th century of Vietnam. The 13th and 14th century Vietnam, Zen was very popular and very flourished with the king who left the kingdom to become Zen master and get enlightened, similar to the Buddha at the time. So the Vietnam King Trump, he left his kingdom and he meditate and he learned and he enlightened. And he come down the mountain and he spread the Vietnamese Zen across. And so that was blossomed for 200 years. And then with the China invasion of Vietnam and all of that colonization, it's been lost until the 19th century. My grandmaster revived the Zen lineage, and now it's the one of the, I think it's the most popular flourish lineage in Vietnam right now that that Ben has been visiting many temples or monastery. So for now, you know, how Ben asked me to share like how to weave it. You know, we talk about Thich Nhat Hanh Plum Village, my Zen lineage, and then the Soto Zen Center, Upaya Zen Center. And then my chaplaincy training at Atlanta Soto Zen in the past year and a half with Emory University. What I hold to my heart as my key for practice is seeing life as it is. The Bodhisattva vow. I know you heard of the Bodhisattva? Like Bodhisattva is like a saint who, you know, be here with his compassion heart to help all beings to the path of enlightenment. Why he's also practiced that path. And so that Bodhisattva vow is really true to my heart. And that is the vow to always live with an awakened mind and help others on that path of awakened to go to the other shore. And recognizing that the Bodhisattva, the Avalokitesvara Bodhisattva, is the one who hears the cries of the world and reach out to help when she hears. I would like to practice that virtue, have the capacity to hold all the joy and the suffering and all of that is, just hold it, hold that space. And Roshi Bonnie Glassman, have you heard of Roshi Bonnie Glassman? Peacemaker Zen lineage. He had the three tenets of not knowing, bearing witness, and consider what will help, or compassionate action. And so I bring that a lot with me in all of my work. Not knowing, because we not know everything. There's always something that we should be curious about. Open up, always learning, always open up to receive. And then bearing witness is the ability to be open and kind of receive everything that it is in front of us, holding the space for all that is, including war, including the war situation. But can we be grounded so that we can be holding space in that channel ground? Can we be grounded and bring our peace and bring our bit of loving, of care to face that so that we not get sucked by it or hooked by it and get suffer our own, which I was there before. Yeah, and then when we grounded, when we have clarity, then we can help others effectively. We can be there for people. And so that is my chaplaincy work, is being there with people when they are suffering and able to just listen, deep listening, to let them share their stories. And then allow them to cry or laugh or whatever that's needed to. And then just give your heart, your love, your care, whatever that's needed. everyone is different. There's no one single method. And so it's the creativity, the skillful mean to be with individual person. So that is my tenet that I adopt from Roshi Bernie Glassman and Roshi John Halifax. Also affects me a lot in her teaching of strong back, soft front. Strong back, soft front. Because our sitting meditation, you know, we sit with our strong back so that we can be upright and we can be rounded. And then soft front is for us to feel, to open, to receive, and not to close our heart. That we're not turning away from anything. That we're there, we're engaging with the world, whatever that is. We're engaging with our own suffering, our own pain. We're also engaging with the people in front of us and the society, the world in front of us. And so that how can we live in the world that we can connect to other with such sacred intimacy, with such meaning and purpose that will bring joy, will bring hope, will bring loving care. And so that is my North Star that I'm practicing, I'm sharing with you, and I bet I trust that you also have your own North Star. And I would like to open up the next 10, 15 minutes for question or for sharing from your heart. Thank you. Yes.
What was your biggest challenge during the transition?
Which transition, Mike?
From the past, totally all this entanglement and living with
career. Oh yeah. Thank you. My biggest challenge, I guess. There's different transition, but the biggest transition is become a nun, and let go of my former worldly life. And so I was very active. It was like, you know, running here and there, doing community work, engaging with a lot of people. But then become a nun, we have certain rules, we have to precept, we have to abiding to, and we have to practice more mindfulness and more subtle. And so that practice is a challenge, but it's also a blessing for me. It's a challenge in a way that I think it's just that the transition, a challenge, you know, the old pattern come up. I'm like, oh, that mistake again, you know. But then we learn, you know, it's okay to make mistake, it's okay to you know, break certain precepts when I don't remember or mindful, but come back, stand up again, and continue. The continuous practice is important, and just be kind to myself so that I can be kind to others. Yeah, so just keep returning, just keep practicing. Yeah, I know that when I look back, I'm like, wow, I have done, you know, like, it's not easy to try to be mindful all the time. Yeah, thank you for your question. Yes.
When you described so beautifully the way that as a teenager you confronted the generational trauma that you had, you know, that you didn't even necessarily know, and you went out and you explored that, learned about that, and then confronted that, and it just struck me that that space that you created for yourself, and that all those things that you did to confront that and work through that, I feel like that might be a key element to for a place like this to engage with the broader community is to specifically create space to process generational trauma. And so I'm wondering what you would say about what you took from that, that you think that another community can, what are the key elements to creating that that space for all of that processing?
Thank you. Yeah, that's very good, very great question. Because I think many of us, not just my particular, but many of us have intergeneration trauma as well. Interracial trauma, intercultural trauma, intergeneration trauma. In family from generation after another. And I think for me, I believe that the key is open heart, open mind, show caring, and communication. Just say, hey, you know, we welcome, or hey, I noticed that, you know, can we talk, or is there something, can I hear your story? You know, show an interest, wanting to learn about the other people, because I keep everything deep down and no one asks me, and I have to work it through myself. Outside, I could be very bubbly, happy in the past, but no one know my internal struggle until I work it through, and then I share it now openly. But it wasn't like that before. Yeah, so I really appreciate your true concern. And one of the mark I would like to share with you all too, I think maybe this related, one of the mark, it was September 11th, we had that incident. And, you know, the decision, war or not war. And I was, of course, peace activist, right? So I was like on the street, you know, protesting for peace as much as possible. And at the end, we have a peace vigil where we came into the city council in Northfield. The council, and we have a group of people sitting around, and each one of us share why do we want to protest for peace. And across from me was a Vietnam veteran who was American, and he was in a chair, wheelchair, and he was very disheveled. And he shared about his experience in Vietnam and why he just wanted to fight for peace, not for war. Because he saw all of that in Vietnam, and his legs were injured, and he'd been on many medication to help his mind calm, you know, mental health. And so across from him is me sharing my own trauma, my own suffering with my family and all of that. And at the end, both of us came without saying a word. We hug each other. We look into each other's eyes, and we hug each other, and we cry. And then the whole room came and hugged us. And it's like the whole room come and hug each other, and everyone cried together. And that was the time that it took away my depression. Somehow after that incident, I was able to connect to someone related to the war of the side, you know, that I never connect with anyone else. And that gave me the hope that humanity is still here. That there's still people with love, with care, with that touch that I did not receive before. And because of that hope, because of that touching deeply to the heart, I felt I'm not alone in my own sadness and my depression. That someone else has also had their own drama book, their own depression, their own issue to go through. So maybe we can do something like that as well. Thank you. Yes?
When you were a teenager, you talked about how everything was very overwhelming and emotionally, you would kind of lose yourself. You would lose yourself in the emotion for the project. And then through the years, I don't imagine you were able to do that in palliative care and the various things that you have done. What would you say are some of the tools or the key ways that as an empath, you're able to sit with other people's suffering and not be overwhelmed by it? Mm-hmm. Yours and others, probably more specifically others. I figured it out with myself pretty good, but others I still struggle with that.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was a long process. It's not that simple with you. So I was a PA in palliative care and in cancer. And my first 2 years in front of patient, I was able to hold my ground because I know my role, right? And I just kind of like compartmentalize. And so when I go home, I just face the wall and just blank. Sometimes I cry for a big long hours because I have to release it. But I only work with by my own, not with anyone else. And so that was hard. But chaplaincy would really help me. Because chaplaincy is we have to step back and work with our own suffering. So there's a lot of processing in the classroom and processing with peers and really open up my heart to be not keeping anything back. But whatever I feel, I have to practice open it up and let it out. And that helped a lot. There were times in chaplaincy where I just talked to a friend and then I start to cry. And I don't know why I cry. Just by a one word trigger. And then my friend, she did some therapeutic work and she's like, was that related to the war that, you know, and then she able to help me process through that. So I think chaplaincy training, chaplaincy is not trained that we're not going out there to solve people's problem or suffering. We're not going to fix people's suffering, but we just be a friend who are walking alongside listening to. But in order to be that friend, we have to be grounded inside. We have to take care of our own emotions first. And that's the work that we do first among our chaplain peers. And sometimes I find myself kind of poor when other people are suffering a pain, poor toward that. But we train to take deep breath, to take a step back, to hold people and focus on something. So there are different kind of training that help me.
Can I do a follow-up?
Yes.
So it sounds like what you're saying is the more you are able to work with your own healing, the more you're able to be grounded to work with someone else's suffering.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes. Yes. Yeah, I would say I don't know, like 100% healing, but maybe majority of it very well. Yeah. Yes.
So what I've heard you say then, in your work as a chaplain, that I just want to make sure I understand exactly what you said, that you kind of hold three things in mind when you're working with people. One is you come with the attitude of not knowing, and you hold space for them, whatever it is.
Yes.
And you walk with them through that.
Yes.
Is that
correct?
Did I get that right?
Yeah. Bearing witness. And then from that, then you really understand what is in their heart, their mind, what is their struggle. And from that, then you know what to do. Somehow, you just have that insight. Whether you will continue listening, holding their hand, just look into the eyes and just say, oh, I cannot imagine how hard this is for you. Sometimes just that symbol. And they say, oh, thank you for listening. I already feel much better now after I share with you. And that's all you need. But sometimes you know their faith, their religions, their spiritual. You touch those parts and you ask deeper questions for them to figure out their own. But it's important for the person to find their own inner strength and inner resilience. Whatever that's the best from them, you help them find that out instead of putting your own ideas. Yes.
Could you describe your order of nuns and like I was thinking in terms of like numbers, maybe growth and what its like, mission is,
yeah,
and so on?
Yeah, sure. So in Vietnam, we have many monasteries in my lineage, and each monastery average is about like 100 person. So my own monastery that I've been visiting in like a couple of days, we have 180 nuns live together. And in the monastery of the monks alone, which is 10 miles away, where my grandmaster staying, he's 100 years old right now. So at that monastery is the main monastery of all the Vietnam, which is have more than 240 or something monks living there. And then other monastery, you know, average, the big monastery, and then the smaller monastery could be like 40, which is smaller size. Here in United States, we came here in 1990 something, like mid 1990, we came here. And we also have maybe more than 20 monasteries in the United States in our lineage. But the number, the residents ranging from 2 to 20. So much less. And the mission is just whoever, you know, follow along the path and find your practice helpful, come to practice with us. We open door to people to wanting to practice. But a lot of our monastery are Vietnamese speaking because we don't have the generation of most of the monks are nuns from Vietnam come here. And so they don't know a lot of English, just a few. And so my generation have become a bridge, which Ben always encouraged me to look at that as a bridge, bridging the East and the West, bridging the older and the younger generations. Thank you. Yes?
Sister Pearl, thank you for your beautiful talk. It was wonderful. Can you speak more about courage, about bravery? I really loved your story about you knew you wanted to be a nun and you had a supportive ex-husband and a supportive Dharma sister, but you still had to take that step, you know? Could you speak about actually, you know, having courage to do that?
Oh, yeah. I think the courage was driven from my witnessing this suffering. I love my ex-husband a lot. It was a pure love, and I really respect and honor him. But I feel that there's a bigger. We need to get out of this suffering. I feel that if I'm staying with him, I create more suffering for myself and for him. And I see somehow, I don't know, I see that when I step out, things will be better. And now he's also very dedicated in his own practice, his personal practice. He wake up every morning, early morning, meditate, reading the sutra before work, and very supportive of monks and nuns. And when he meet me, he very respectfully bowed to me as a nun. And so we keep that, you know, now we are a spiritual brother and sister. But the courage, because I witnessed so many suffering, and I felt it in my body, in my bones, in my flesh. And that helped me really, no matter what, I need to walk this path of liberation. And I found, you know, not the whole liberation, the big liberation, but I found small liberation along the path. And I enjoy that. And when I'm with other people, I share that with them, just by being with them, a true presence, and they enjoy that too. So it works. Thank you.
Sister Pearl, thank you so much for coming here.